From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll speak with a local journalist investigating Brady lists, which track police officers accused of misconduct. Then, a Milwaukee Public Schools teacher shares how she's comforting children afraid of deportations and how she's helping families.
If I'm getting in trouble for doing a good thing, then so be it. I'll get in trouble as many times as I need to in order to be able to provide the resources and help my families need it.
Plus, we'll learn about a new tool that's tracking overdoses in Milwaukee County and learn how it could be useful.
This allows you to really determine what organizations are you going to work with? What doors are you going to knock on? What churches or grocery stores or barbershops are you going to go and talk to folks about and talk to how to prevent overdose?
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. We'll start with a collaborative investigation a group of local journalists have taken on regarding Brady lists. A Brady list is a list of law enforcement officers with credibility concerns. Officers can be on the list for a variety of reasons: a history of dishonesty, criminal convictions, or other concerns. The list is meant to help people who've been accused of a crime. Among other things, it can be a reference for a lawyer to learn whether or not a police witness has credibility to testify against a defendant. Recently, Milwaukee County released their Brady list of nearly 200 names. Investigative reporter Ashley Luthern joins WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez to share about her reporting, which is featured in today's Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
What is the Brady list, and why wasn't it public in the first place?
The Brady list is a list of officers, law enforcement personnel, who are known to have documented credibility issues. It's a list that's historically been maintained by the DA's office, and they maintain it to fulfill what are called Brady obligations. Brady obligations are anything really that could help a person prove their innocence when they are charged with a crime. It's a requirement under the U.S. legal system that prosecutors provide this information. And it's a wide range. Brady material encompasses a wide range of potential evidence. What we are specifically talking about are pieces of evidence that relate to credibility, because oftentimes officers, specifically police officers, are the key witnesses in criminal prosecutions.
Thinking of that then in the relationship to the Brady list, to the district attorney's office, what was it like to get that information from the DA's office?
This project is undertaken with media partners, including Wisconsin Watch and WTMJ Channel 4. Wisconsin Watch last year published a really great report that showed how inconsistent Brady lists are maintained by district attorney's offices across the state. So in all 72 counties, you have different ways of prosecutors maintaining that information, disclosing it. Some said they had no officers on the list. Others said that they didn't maintain a list at all. Others did furnish a list. One of those who provided a list at the time was Milwaukee County. However, it was only officers who had been criminally charged or convicted of a criminal offense. Brady material can include any documented instance of credibility concerns, and so that would also include internal violations. So in Milwaukee County, they also had a subset of this list that they had withheld from the public for quite a while that related to internal violations of officers. Now, to be clear, the DA's office said they always would provide that information to defense attorneys when those officers were involved in cases. They maintained very strongly that they have always fulfilled their Brady obligations. For us as reporters and members of the public, we weren't sure who was on it. And frankly, neither, in some cases, were the officers. So those two groups, the defense attorneys and the police unions, both are quite concerned about the standards that are used to have people placed on the list, how long people stay on the list, if there's ever an opportunity for officers to contest their placement on the list, and from the defense attorney's perspective, referring information to the prosecutors that they turn up in their own investigations on behalf of their clients that they feel goes to credibility. In Milwaukee County, the district attorney's office maintains that anytime we get new information, we review it and we determine if it is appropriate for an officer to be added to the Brady list or to possibly be removed. But for a long time, it's been difficult for people to even know what this list is or who's on it when part of it has always been withheld. And part of the reason it's been withheld is because the DA's office maintained that those internal violations related to public records that were not in their purview. So if an officer had been criminally charged with an offense, a prosecutor would be issuing that charge. If they had been internally disciplined, that's coming from their own agency. However, our point as media organizations was, those are all public records. And so when the DA's office did finally release their full Brady list in September of last year, they released it with a lot of caveats, one of them being they couldn't guarantee the accuracy of all the information on the list. And that included whether officers were still employed with those agencies, that included whether or not they had been convicted of specific offenses. And so my colleagues at TMJ and Wisconsin Watch and I, we spent 5 months requesting records underlying all of these officers, comparing it with past media coverage to really try to figure out how these people ended up on the list.
Can I ask you about the last 5 months then? Because it feels like putting together that list and then doing all the shoe leather reporting that you all have been doing, I'm sure that you found some things that maybe surprised you, or maybe about the process that surprised you. So what did you find on the list, and have you heard anything from officials?
I think what surprised us was how inconsistent it was. At least 5 officers on the list were now deceased. They'd been deceased for quite a while. So that raised questions for us as to how often this information is reviewed, kind of independently by the DA's office. There was an officer who was listed as having been involved with a custody death. He was not. We found no evidence that he had been involved with that. He had a different kind of integrity concern, but not a custody death as was listed on the DA's list. At least 2 officers were listed with the wrong agencies. And some of this might sound a little nitpicky to some, but this is a public record that is critically important to ensuring people have a fair trial. Because ultimately what this all is about is that there is enough information for someone to consider their defense because they are facing a loss of their liberty. You know, they are facing possible incarceration time if they are charged with a crime. And just because an officer is on the Brady list doesn't mean that that information automatically comes into a courtroom. There are still other layers of review. A defense attorney has to look at it and say, this actually might help in this specific case. And then if they decide that, they have to take it to a judge. And then a judge decides if it's relevant or not. But none of that can happen unless there is an adequate record of these integrity concerns that are raised in the first place. It's sort of like trying to know an unknown. You have to have the information as a starting point.
Thinking of credibility concerns and officers often being the primary witness to X, Y, or Z happening, I guess I'm curious, how can officers still be employed or employable if they're on the Brady list, if they have these credibility concerns that would jeopardize their ability to do their job and to appear in a courtroom?
We asked Police Chief Jeff Norman and Sheriff Danita Ball what they would say to community members who are concerned about people being on the Brady list and currently still being employed with their agencies. As best we can tell, again, with the public records we were able to obtain and answers from these different agencies, about 2 dozen officers who are on the list, and there are about 190 or so, remain employed as law enforcement officers in Milwaukee County. And the response from the police chief and the sheriff was, people can make a mistake. The Brady list does appear to encompass quite a wide range of behavior. You know, for example, there's an officer who's listed who cheated on an exam by writing on his hand. That goes to integrity. Does that mean that person can never serve as a police officer, right? At the far, far end of the other spectrum are the officers who were federally convicted of civil rights crimes for beating Frank Jude. Mm-hmm. So huge spectrum of conduct there. And obviously, those Frank Jude officers have long not been employed. And from the perspective of law enforcement, what they were explaining to us is that they weigh each individual case. They look at the seriousness of the infraction. In the case of Chief Norman, he looks at an officer's work history. He looks at the facts of the current case. He looks at similar discipline, and he gets input from the rest of his command staff before he makes a discipline decision. If the district attorney's office were to tell him, he said, that an officer's testimony would never be used, in that case, he said he would have no choice but to make sure that that person was no longer with the agency. That situation, sometimes referred to as being Giglio'd, that's named after another Supreme Court case, happens pretty rarely, according to District Attorney Kent Lovern. Mm-hmm. He said in his recollection in the past 18 years, there maybe were three people who he would consider. He would absolutely never call them to testify, and they all have not been in law enforcement for many, 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 many years.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I know you've been covering crime and public safety for a long time in the city, but you also were working with, as you said, TMJ and then Wisconsin Watch out of Madison. What was the dynamic of that group process to come together and sift over all of this information, all these documents over the last 5 months, and what we see now in this reporting?
I think this process has shown the power of collaboration. We all tell stories in slightly different ways. Certainly TV is a very different format. And it really was helpful to have so many people reviewing information and going off and getting public records. I mean, we were getting records from police agencies, from courthouses. We were looking up old archival newspaper coverage, TV coverage, and going through hundreds and maybe even thousands of pages of records. And to do that in a relatively short amount of time, I would say 5 months, is only possible when you have other people working on it with you.
What do you expect to come after this reporting, and what can we expect from your reporting?
I want to be very clear that District Attorney Kent Lovern has been very open to receiving the information that we provided. As a result of the information and questions that we raised, he ultimately removed 7 people from the Brady list. He also notably said that there was an individual who we brought to his attention who should have been placed on the Brady list years earlier. And because of that, his office is currently reviewing any case in which that officer was a state's witness. And anyone who's convicted in those cases, they are now notifying that individual and their attorney so that they can decide if that factors into any further litigation they want to undergo. By the same token, you'll see in further reporting, we have found other cases where officers have been deemed to have lied or not told the whole truth when they were in court, in a civil proceeding or a criminal proceeding. And some of those officers are not on the list. And the district attorney has held firm in his decision on that. So we'll be exploring that in further articles. And so I expect a conversation about what the purpose of this list is, how it's maintained, and if there should be broader standards, not just in Milwaukee County, but statewide, for how this information is compiled, who is placed on a list, and how it is ultimately presented to the public.
Ashley Luthern is an investigative reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She spoke with WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez. Deportations were a hallmark of President Donald Trump's second campaign for the White House. On Inauguration Day, he signed executive orders rolling back protections from Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, detaining people at locations like schools and places of worship. Allowing ICE agents in these sensitive places has stoked fear among immigrant communities, and some school districts across the country have even reported a drop in attendance. WUWM education reporter Catherine Kokel spoke with an MPS teacher about how she handles her students' fears around deportations. Alondra Garcia teaches second grade at Allenfield Elementary, where most students are Hispanic. Garcia was temporarily suspended by the school district late last year for starting a group chat with parents to share tips for interacting with ICE and information about how MPS can protect students while in school.
What made you feel the need to share information about immigration enforcement with your students and their parents?
Yeah, so it was about 2 weeks after Trump had won the elections, and I felt the need to share it because I know a lot of our families are undocumented, don't have the legal status, and I just had a hunch that a couple of them were worried because even the students were talking about it and their fear of what would happen, right, in regards to family separation and possible ICE raids. So I acted in the best interest of my families, and I just sent out an initial message to families stating that essentially if parents needed resources in order to best be prepared if there were ICE raids to show up at work or at their home, that these resources would help them. to know their rights, right? And know what, how to act and what to say and what to do in those situations. And I had asked the parents if they wanted those resources to message me directly so I could provide it to whoever needed it, right? Essentially, because not all of my families need it. It's a, you know, a pretty mixed classroom I have, right? Some have status, some don't, some have temporary status. It's a diverse classroom with diverse needs.
When you mentioned that shortly after Trump won the election, you started hearing from students, you have second grade students, right? And so
yes.
What were you hearing from them? What were they asking? What kind of questions yeah. were they asking you? What kind of stresses were they sharing at school? Can you share some of those stories?
Yeah, they were really saddened by the fact that he won, you know, just because they know from the news stories and what they've heard of Trump is that he's not a very kind person. I had one student specifically tell me, like, why is Trump so mean towards immigrants? Like, why does he hate us so much? And that really, you know, hurt me hearing that from like one of my students, because essentially that's something that bothered him and it still bothers him to this day. Because he's one of those students that was fearful of coming to school, and mom was explaining to me that he was scared of not coming. And essentially after what had happened to me, he was scared that I wouldn't show up at school. So he felt like if I didn't show up, he didn't want to show up either. So obviously it's affected my students, how attached they are to me, and how much they care for me. So with even more reason, I feel like my duty, it's more than just being a classroom teacher.
When students brought concerns about immigration crackdowns to you, what did you say to them? I mean, they're 7 and 8 years old. How do you explain these complex issues to such young students?
It's hard. There's no way to sugarcoat it. You have to be as real as you can be to them in a way that they can understand how the system works, right? And that the system doesn't favor us immigrants. It never has. And they take that to the heart, right? And it's something that hurts them to hear, but it's something I have to let them know that at the moment, the leader of the government, right, is anti-immigrant and he doesn't see the benefits we bring to the country, right? How essential we are. The fact that now schools are no longer considered safe, right? These sensitive locations are no longer protected is scary. I tell them, you know, that our district, it has a safe haven policy in place, and we will do everything we can in our hands to protect you, right? Us as teachers, that's our duty to follow this policy and make sure that we're following through with what's expected from us and that we will not tolerate any form of intimidation. So that brings them a sense of relief of feeling that they're safe. But I mean, reality is that we don't know if ICE will even acknowledge that, right? We don't know what directives they've been given in regards to how they will handle potential, whatever you want to call it, ICE raids at schools, because it's never happened, at least that I know of in Milwaukee, in the public school district. You know, it's nearing us. It happened in Chicago. It's happened across the country in a couple of other cities. Like, we don't know when we're next. So that's the thing, not knowing, right? It's just kind of being always alert, right? Vigilant of the worst, and just having to be like that at all times is traumatic. It's a lot to carry on as a kid and as an educator who, you know, fears for her own safety. So, you know, I'm carrying all these worries from my kids, but also my own. It's a lot. It's something that people who don't have to worry about that could ever relate to.
I think some of the information that you provided also kind of dispels rumors, right? There is not a situation in which immigration and customs enforcement can come to a school, you know, like a workplace raid, and ask for a list of students who are undocumented and detain all of them. I mean, not only does this school district not have that information, ICE needs a signed warrant by a judge to remove a student from class. And so even in sharing these tips, you have kind of deconstructed a lot of people's fears about what could be happening in our schools. So it helps just empower people to understand where their information is and where their information isn't. And, you know, no teacher, no school district has a list of students who are undocumented and would be willing to give that up, right?
Exactly.
Following your suspension by the school district for the way in which you shared this information, how do you feel about protecting your students?
I feel even more empowered. I just like to say, like, if I'm getting in trouble for doing a good thing, then so be it. I'll get in trouble as many times as I need to in order to be able to provide the resources and help my families need it. And I know I did a good thing, and I know other people will see that for that. So I essentially don't care much about what I have in my file. That's the least of my concerns, is just knowing my families are safe and feel safe and have a game plan in case, you know, the worst is to happen.
You are in a place with your citizenship status and your path to residency where you feel safe kind of advocating. I wonder if you could speak to that a little bit. You are working with people who are, for all intents and purposes, less protected than you are and more vulnerable, obviously people with young children. How does that make you feel?
It makes me feel like I have a duty. That's my duty, to advocate for these families, because that was my family at one point of my life. And I see myself in them, in wanting to have had someone like myself, right, advocating for them and their rights, and making sure that they feel like their kid is safe at school, right? And that they're ready, because someone gave them, an educator who cared enough about their safety, gave them the necessary resources that they need. It's something I carry dear to my heart, and I don't see it any other way, right? A kid can't learn if they don't feel safe at school. Simple as that. So that's a priority of mine, and it should be for every educator, any person who works with children and works with their families.
Alondra Garcia is a second grade bilingual teacher at Allen Field Elementary School. She was suspended by Milwaukee Public Schools for sharing information about ICE and parents' constitutional rights. She spoke to WUWM education reporter Catherine Kokel. For more information on constitutional rights and to read a version of this story in Spanish, visit WUWM.com. Did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcast to download and listen on demand. In about 10 minutes, we'll speak with a Milwaukee native about his debut essay collection that's all about going down memory lane through pop culture. But first, there's a new way to track and understand overdose deaths in Milwaukee County. We'll tell you how that information being public could help health outcomes. That's coming up on Lake Effect on WUWM. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The latest effort to fight the opioid crisis in Milwaukee County is being driven by data. On the county's Office of Emergency Management website, visitors can access the overdose dashboard and filter data by year, municipality, race, gender, and more. Dr. Ben Weston is the Milwaukee County Chief Health Policy Advisor. He joins WUWM's Eddie Morales to explain the two data sets being collected and why the county is making the information publicly accessible.
The Milwaukee County Overdose Dashboard is our newest dashboard. We've released a fair number of dashboards to really focus on the health of Milwaukee County and how to enable not just us as a county, but all the community partners we work with, all the individuals in our county who are interested in it, on how to promote health. So we've done a cardiac arrest dashboard. Of course, this all started with our COVID-19 dashboard, but now we're doing this overdose dashboard. And what it does is it shows two different data sets. One is EMS data of folks who overdosed but luckily survived that overdose. And then it shows medical examiner data of fatalities that result from overdose. And so you can look at this, these two rich data sets in detail and really understand a lot of different trends in overdoses, trends by age, trends by race, ethnicity, by municipality, trends by individual substance that people have on board through the medical examiner's office. And so you can really get a lot of insight into where overdoses are occurring in our community.
And you mentioned trends. Are there any specific communities or demographics that are being disproportionately affected? And if so, why?
Absolutely. So when we look at communities, for example, the city of Milwaukee certainly has more overdoses per capita than any other municipality, but it's followed by West Allis that also is disproportionate to the others. Now, one of the nice things about this dashboard is it's a county dashboard, but it can also be a municipality dashboard. There's a dropdown where you can click Franklin, you can click Whitefish Bay, you can click Wauwatosa, and all of a sudden that the entire dashboard is just focused around that one municipality and really becomes a municipal dashboard instead of a county dashboard. So that allows you to see trends within your own community. Now, the other thing when you ask about the trends that we're seeing, when you start kind of slicing and dicing the data and putting different filters in, you see some really interesting things. So for example, from 2022 to 2023, we saw our first decline in opioid overdoses. And that was really encouraging. It was only a few percent, but it was the first decline in 6 years. But the fact of the matter is when you start parsing that out, you parse it out by race, ethnicity, you parse it out by gender, you parse it out by age, you see that, yeah, as a group in Milwaukee County, overdoses went down. But among certain groups, it actually went up. So one of the groups that went up the most was Black men between the ages of about 55 and 75. And among that age group, you actually see about a 26% year-over-year increase in overdose deaths between 2022 and 2023. And so when you're thinking about how to create a community program, this allows you to really determine what organizations are you going to work with? What doors are you going to knock on? What churches or grocery stores or barbershops are you going to go and talk to folks about and talk to how to prevent overdose?
Can you tell me a little bit about how data is collected?
Absolutely. So there's two different data sets. So the first data set is our EMS data. Now, our EMS system in Milwaukee County, one of the largest systems in the country, and that's because we're comprised of 14 different fire departments throughout the county. So anytime you call 911, the call is going to go to one of those 14 fire departments who's going to facilitate that response. And so that's our first data set. And we look at all sorts of things within that data set. We look at these near fatal overdoses. We look at naloxone. How often is the reversal agent for opioids naloxone given? What communities, what populations, who's giving it? Is it police? Is it or is it law enforcement? Is it EMS? Who's giving that naloxone? And then that other data set is the medical examiner's data. And that's a very different data set because, of course, that's folks who unfortunately had fatal overdoses. But they also had a lot more testing that went along with that. And so we can see trends in substances, for example. We can see over time that heroin has really gone down and, you know, fentanyl has really taken over the drug supply. We can even see interesting things like combinations. What are the top combinations of drugs that are creating fatal overdoses? So there's all sorts of data and all sorts of trends we can get from these really rich data sets.
In 2023, the county installed Narcan vending machines in public spaces to make life-saving supplies more accessible. And last year, there were 200 fewer overdose deaths compared to 2023. Can you cite any reasons for the previous increase and then now the recent decrease in those numbers?
Yeah, absolutely. So when we look at why there was the previous increase, boy, we could talk for hours about that. But basically, there's been three to four, depending on who you talk to, waves of opioid use patterns. So it started off with prescriptions. A lot of this started with drugs like OxyContin in the earlier 2000s, and a lot of folks getting OxyContin and then an oxycodone. And then as that drug supply started going down a bit, folks turned to cheaper alternatives that were available on the street, like heroin. And then that changed to fentanyl. And now we're seeing this fourth wave where stimulants start to get involved, cocaine, methamphetamine mixed with fentanyl. But all that is to say that we've seen significant increases. As you mentioned, it's not just Milwaukee County. It's not just Wisconsin. It's nationally in communities across the country. These same trends have been seen with increases in overdose deaths. Now, you talk about our harm reduction vending machines. Those are some of the downstream measures that we're taking in Milwaukee County to address opioid use disorder. So it's things like harm reduction vending machines, getting naloxone, getting fentanyl test strips, getting drug storage, drug disposal kits out there into the community in a very low barrier way. These are free vending machines. You just walk up, you push the button, and it drops out like anything else, but you don't have to pay any money. We're also getting it out there in different sort of ways. Every fire department now carries harm reduction supplies. A lot of our law enforcement agencies, including Milwaukee County Sheriff, carry naloxone and will hand it to folks, no questions asked. That's pretty unusual to go up to a law enforcement officer and say, can I have an opioid reversal agent? And they give it to you and they don't want your name. They don't want any information about you. And so that's some of the downstream work we're doing. Another example would be Milwaukee County EMS system, our 911 services, our ambulance services. We're the first in the state to introduce medication-assisted treatment. It's called buprenorphine. It's similar to methadone, to give folks in the field and give them about a 3 times better chance of recovery than just stopping cold turkey alone. And so those are some of the downstream measures that we've been taking. But then Milwaukee County, of course, is working upstream as well on things like housing, things like healthcare access, things like transportation that affect not only substance use disorder, but so many other issues in our community, not just tomorrow, but for years and decades to come.
Overall, how does this tool fit into the broader strategy of mitigating substance abuse and reducing overdoses? And are there any plans to expand or enhance the dashboard's features in the future?
Yeah, that's a great question. So to the first part, I think this tool fits in any way you want it to fit in. And what I mean by that is I think everyone will use it differently. I think we're going to have community organizations that'll want to look at the trends. I think we're going to have media outlets that are going to want to talk about it and see what kind of demographics are being affected differently. And I think we're going to have fire departments, we're going to have law enforcement agencies, we're going to have researchers, we're going to have all these different folks who use this dashboard in a different way. But I think what they'll all have in common is they're using it to try to figure out what is the best approach, what is the most targeted approach, what approach is going to have the most impact, rather than figuring out an intervention for a million residents of Milwaukee County. You might figure out an intervention for older Black men in Milwaukee County that are showing the highest degree or the highest increase of overdose deaths. And that sort of targeted initiative is what's really going to make a difference, as opposed to spending a lot of time on a huge population, many of whom are going to have lower impact. You want to focus your efforts on where you're going to have the most impact. And by the way, that's what equity is, right? Equity is not a bad word. It's talking about focusing your resources where you're going to have the most impact. And that's what we're working to do in Milwaukee County.
Dr. Ben Weston is the Milwaukee County Chief Health Policy Advisor. He spoke with WUWM's Eddie Morales. We've got a new season of Bubbler Talk starting this week, so we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. We'll take one more break, and then author Ira Madison III joins us to share his new book of essays that weaves together pop culture, nostalgia, social commentary, and much more. Keep listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Milwaukee native Ira Madison III is a cultural critic, TV writer, and host of the Crooked Media podcast, Keep It. Last month, he added author to his many titles with the release of his debut essay collection, Pure Innocent Fun. The book explores key cultural moments that inspired his career as a critic and impacted his life growing up as a Black gay man in Milwaukee. For Madison, TV shows, movies, and books were not just an escape, but turned out to be a tool for connection. He takes readers on a trip through the 90s and 2000s, diving into everything from Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Oprah's talk show, and weekly trips to Mayfair Mall to see as many films as he could. Ira Madison III joins me to share more, and to start, here's an excerpt from Pure Innocent Fun.
February 2nd, 1999 marked the release of the most important historical text since the Bible. The Bible, of course, being the print edition of Entertainment Weekly, February 1990 to April 2022. A scrub is a guy that can't get no love from me, hanging out the passenger side of his best friend's ride, trying to holla at me. TLC's No Scrubs was a seminal text for me, the version with Left Eye's rap only. Not only because it was a massive hit, but because my mom and sister routinely lobbed the lyrics at me over the fact that I never got my driver's license in high school. For most teenagers in Milwaukee, a car represents freedom. For instance, my younger sister got her driver's permit as soon as she could. But for me, who had a life that revolved around watching TV and walking to the comic book store and going to the movies at the mall, Mayfair Mall, there didn't seem to be much of a need to get my license. Besides, driver's ed seemed to happen immediately after school, and that coincided with rehearsals for the school plays. I worked on the stage crew for each show at Marquette University High School because I was finding myself falling in love with theater more and more. And if I couldn't be cast in a show, then I'd at least take a job that would let me take part in all the magic that I dreamed about when I would listen to the Rent original Broadway cast recording in my bedroom and try to make my high-pitched gay voice deep enough to match Adam Pascal's raspy voice on the song Another Day.
Ira Madison III, welcome to Lake Effect. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
So first off, congratulations on your first book, Pure Innocent Fun. It's a collection of essays that shares stories and snippets of your life through the connective lens of pop culture, and specifically millennial pop culture. So first off, what was the inspiration for you to write these memories to share with us in this format?
Well, so my favorite book in high school was Chuck Klosterman's Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs. And I think that was maybe the first thing, aside from like VH1's Best Week Ever, or, you know, like the I Love the 80s franchise, that introduced me to people talking about pop culture, talking about their memories of pop culture and how they influenced their lives, how they sort of made the decade make sense in a way. And I revisited that book often. I lent it to friends and I got it back. And I think around 2020, you know, when we were all at home for a very long time, I reread it for the first time, maybe in a few years. And it sort of hit me that I wanted to make my own version of that and a version that was sort of a tribute to that.
What's most central in your book is, of course, Milwaukee, right? And your formative years here. And I have to say that reading this gave me such a nostalgia hit and comfort, not just as a millennial, but also as a Milwaukee native like yourself. So the visualizations were particularly strong, and it felt like reminiscing. Yeah, it just felt like reminiscing about the early aughts with a friend and like all the stupid things we did in high school or the things that were happening in pop culture, what we were obsessing over, you know. So can you share more about your upbringing here in Milwaukee and how it influenced not simply the essays you wrote, but of course your whole perspective?
Yeah, you know, my earliest memories that I write about are when I attended Highland Community School as a kid, and that led me to Morse Middle School. And I really enjoyed those schools a lot. Those were some of the more diverse schools in Milwaukee. And then after middle school, my culture shock was going to Marquette High School, which was an all-boys school. And at the time, you know, it was a largely all-white school too. So I think that that is something that definitely affected, you know, my upbringing and also sort of just thrust me into a world I wasn't really familiar with. And I think I retreated a lot into myself. I retreated a lot into books, into TV, into film. And the way that I was able to make friends with people was through discussing pop culture, discussing Seinfeld reruns, discussing Simpsons reruns, and spending nights watching movies with friends in their parents' basements. And that, I think, prepared me for college, where I was able to, you know, not connect with people as easily socially as other people immediately, but I could connect with people on music and pop culture. And I think that that really just sort of led me down the career path that I've had ever since.
Yeah, we grow up with these things and we latch on to like shows or movies, like maybe without knowing the significance at the time. And, you know, while I don't share the same experiences as you, such as going to Marquette High as one of a handful of Black students at a predominantly white school, I have to say I deeply empathize hard with the way you wrote about escaping into TV, movies, fanfic, you know, everything that gives you a safe space mentally. So do you think this is why pop culture and the nostalgia around it can be so powerful?
Yeah, I think that especially in a world, you know, where we have so much niche culture now, you know, there's not the monoculture of whatever was on TV last night, chances are everyone watched it, you know? And if you didn't watch it, your parents watched it or your sibling watched it, you were at least familiar with it, you know? And now I think with there being so many disparate things to watch, you know, not everyone is watching Severance, you know? Not people barely watch network TV. Maybe, you know, Real Housewives is sort of a monoculture, but, you know, I have friends who don't watch that as well, you know? And I think that these memories of things that we all love, that we all remember, sort of one, remind you of a place and time when you consume them, and then they also help you connect with your peers. There's this thing that people always say, and I mentioned it in the book, where you remember experiencing something in the past, and in a way, it feels like you were the only person who experienced that, like you and your friends. How many times have you seen a viral post online where someone starts with the prompt, name a TV show that you've watched that you're pretty sure no one else has ever seen, et cetera. And sometimes people name shows that were pretty popular, like everyone's seen ER or Friends, yeah. And they've heard about it. But, you know, sometimes people will name much smaller shows that were canceled, you know, like a Pushing Daisies, shows that were canceled very quickly. And I think that when you go back and actually look at how many people watch those shows, we lived in a culture where, sure, the biggest shows on television got maybe 30 million viewers a week. And that show got maybe 10 million a week. And that's why it was canceled. But in this day and age, 10 million viewers a week would be a huge hit, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of the things that felt niche and small to us at the time, millions of people actually have that same experience, you know? I think we just did not have the internet. We didn't have social media. We didn't have a way to know that the things that you were experiencing by yourself at home were lived experiences that many people had, not just in the U.S., but across the globe.
You know, in your books and your experiences, it's not just the power of pop culture, but especially the queer perspective of pop culture. And I think that also is a big factor in how millennials today are also viewing things, not just of their past, but today. Like before, it'd be all about little hints of subtext we could get, right? But, mm-hmm. you know, it's more than that. It's camp. It's the random things we obsess over. And you have a podcast all about that too, right? So can you explain the importance of that lens?
Yeah. So my podcast, Keep It, which I've hosted for about 7 years now with my co-host, Louis Vertel, we dive into current pop culture each week, but we also always divert into nostalgic moments that we remember, sort of our tastes that have been developed by how we view things as young queer people in the 90s and early 2000s. And I think that it gives us also a different lens into pop culture right now. Films that might seem on the surface a lot more queer, you know, that there's characters who are explicitly gay, you know, there people talk about their real queer lives, but no, it feels a little bit like when you watch maybe films from the 50s or something, you know, or sort of like pre-code films where people had to talk in code and there was innuendo. And in a way, it feels like some of those pieces of culture are a lot more queer than many of the things that we experience now, just because people had to work with intent to really make those characters seem gay, really make those characters connect with an audience who would understand it. And now it just seems as if you can throw a character in something, say they're gay, and move on, you know?
I'm going to take a quick moment to reintroduce you. This is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski, speaking with author and Milwaukee native Ira Madison III. So Ira, you've written for GQ, Vulture, The Cut, and MTV News, among others, but a story assignment obviously is very different to writing about your life through the lens of pop culture. So did you have any aspects of writing this book that felt strange or intimidating to you at first? Like, did it take a minute to find your voice when you're used to like, okay, this is my editorial voice on this one thing, but okay, we're getting personal now?
Yeah, you know, I have a very distinct writing style. You know, I called it ADD earlier, but I feel like comes across in my writing style too. I write the way that I speak. I write the way that I discuss topics on the podcast as well. We will, for instance, be talking about the Golden Globes and the wins, and then we will all of a sudden divert into, you know, we'll talk about a film that won and we'll talk about the actor that was in that. And that will lead us into talking about other films of theirs and someone else who was in that movie. You know, I feel like it's my book is sort of like a road trip and you're making a lot of different stops along the way, but you're eventually going to get to the destination. And when I write an assignment, which is much shorter, you know, something like 900 to 1200 words, it's edited down a lot, for one, and those diversions maybe only happen once. You know, you start with an intro topic, and then you veer into the meat of your story, and then maybe you'll end with a kicker that's surprising or something, you know? And I think that I got so used to writing like that, you know, like it's you get an assignment, especially when you're writing about pop culture and it moves so fast, especially with the internet, you get an assignment in the morning and you need it done by the afternoon. This was sitting with topics that nothing was changing about them. You know, there wasn't new information. I didn't have to rush it out. And I was also reflecting more on my perspective and how much I wanted to share about my life. And, yeah, it felt like it went on forever, you know, trying to write, trying to get to that destination in each essay. And luckily, I found a healthy balance. I found a mode of doing that that worked after the first couple of essays. But just starting the book was probably the hardest aspect of it for me.
Absolutely. In your book, you stated, especially in your teenage years, that you were on a diet of white pop culture media in a rejection of your mother. And, you know, I think a lot of families can identify with that. And also, if my family is good at one thing, it's not asking questions, especially Midwestern families. I'm sure it goes beyond the Midwest, right? But in writing this book, how have you felt sharing it with your family and the people closest to you?
Well, they have not read it yet. So
to be determined.
They will get their copies of the book in person when I do my stop in Milwaukee.
I know. It must be a scary thought, though, because you were living in your own world and your brain processing, living life as best you could while they have one perspective of it, too, right?
Exactly. Yeah. But also, I would say that I'm less worried about some family members, particularly my grandmother, who I dedicate the book to. She is an avid fan of mine. She is the one who always encouraged me to write a book when I was younger. She's the one who would always take me to the bookstore after school. She was excited that I was finally writing a book after doing, you know, media and television for so long, just because she knew it was a dream I'd had when I was a kid. And she listens to the podcast sometimes too. And, you know, you sort of forget that that's happening. But sometimes she'll bring up something and I'm like, oh, you read that. And it's happened a couple other times where my mom or my sister has read something very personal and I forget that they're going to be reading it. So I'm pretty okay with my family reading those things. And, you know, I've sort of told them, if there's something here you don't like, then you'll have to keep that to yourself.
It's already printed.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, before I let you go, I have a pressing question. So we got Buffy, some other great TV representation. What's your take on Xena Warrior Princess? She wasn't included in your book.
I love Xena Warrior Princess. I thought I maybe had something in there earlier that might have gotten cut. I made a reference to Hercules, the TV series. which, and I say that, you know, Kevin Sorbo, don't love him now, but right. I did love Hercules. Xena, perfect television show. I've contemplated a rewatch many times, but before Buffy, for me, there was Xena, and I watched Xena every week. Every time she threw her weapon, every time she made her battle cry, I was all in on Xena, and the family was too. That was a show that everybody in the house loved.
Oh, I love that. Well, thank you, Ira, so much for talking with me today. I really enjoyed reading your book and kind of going down your memory lane and remembering stuff on my part as well, and so enjoyed talking with you.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I really appreciate it.
Milwaukee native Ira Madison III is a cultural critic, TV writer, and host of the Crooked Media podcast, Keep It. His new collection of essays is called Pure Innocent Fun, out now. And that wraps up today's show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, you'll hear our most recent on-site live show at UW-Milwaukee, where we celebrated WUWM's history. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Oh,